Good morning, Your Honor. Peter Brennan on behalf of Nissan North America. May it please the Court. Our briefs make 9 arguments for why the judgment of the trial court cannot stand. I'm happy to answer questions about any of them. But in the time allotted today, my time is to focus on just 2. First, the lack of an actionable misrepresentation. And second, the lack of evidence to prove an ascertainable loss by the entire class. The second point compels reversal without getting into any issues about representations and what are actionable. Plaintiff obtained certification from the appellate court, Judge Smart, by claiming that he could prove that stigma reduced the value of every class vehicle. But when the case was remanded, plaintiff went and got an expert, an expert who was a PhD in economics, a professor at the University of Missouri. And what did his expert tell him? Well, he really couldn't prove that. When we took his deposition, he admitted that plaintiff's stigma theory was not consistent with economic reality, that the named plaintiff, the class representative, Dr. Hurst, who had had a dashboard replaced for free, that he had no loss. With the economic realities against him, the plaintiff tried an end around and cherry-picked a handful of unrepresentative witnesses who had unremedied bubbling to testify at trial. That testimony could not establish plaintiff's stigma theory. The plaintiff admits he had a proof. Allowing a judgment to stand based on such testimony would be inconsistent with Missouri law and violate Nissan's due process rights. Now, turning to the...
No one testified who had a replaced dashboard? That they had a loss in value of their vehicle?
There was only one witness who had a replaced dashboard who testified, and her testimony was, in the future, she thought that it could affect her resale value.
So that would be the stigma theory, but you have an argument that can't apply to other class members?
That absolutely cannot apply to other class members. The only reason she was allowed to testify in the first place, and we objected to that testimony because we think it's pure speculation, not based on anything, but that aside, the only reason she was allowed to testify in the first place is because it had to do with her specific car. The cases are very clear, whether it's real estate, whether it's personality, that you can't testify concerning other people's, the value of other people's, and particularly the future value of other people's.
Were there any subclasses here, or were subclasses requested?
No, there were no subclasses requested, and there were no subclasses here. And that's the point, that they had to prove this on behalf of the entire class. That obviously was their choice. They could have done subclasses or something like that. It wouldn't have made a difference in this case because there's not an actionable misrepresentation in any event. But the evidence simply isn't there.
What's the cases? Do they recognize the validity of an owner or the admissibility of an owner's testimony as to future value of their own property?
Yeah, there's actually nothing on that. In fact, so it's pure. In this case, it's purely speculative.
The cases are the present value of property.
Correct. The present and in some cases the past value of a property, but basically the present value. And even there, there are cases that limit that. So somebody wanted to testify that his car had been hit, and I think the loss was $1,000 or $1,500. And this court said that's not good enough, that is not a strong enough reasoning unless you have something behind it. Pure speculation is not enough. So with respect to misrepresentation, plaintiff's theory comes down to the claim that when Nissan used the word premium, this was an actionable promise that the FX could never develop a defect. This is simply nonsense. Using the word premium plainly isn't a promise of anything specific, much less that the FX could never develop a defect. It's especially ludicrous here, given that the FX came with a warranty, which is essentially a statement saying things will go wrong with this car, and we will fix them under certain conditions, the conditions typically being 4 years or 60,000 miles. In this case, Nissan actually extended the warranty to 8 years, unlimited miles. And the promise here needs to be that the defect would never occur. Because remember, what they're saying here is for Dr. Hurst, the class representative, they're saying, oh, his dashboard was replaced for free. He doesn't have any loss from that. But they're saying, you promised that it never happened. So you have to compensate him for that happening. And there's simply nothing in the words of what's here in the brochures and the other things that they rely on that says anything near that. This court's decision in Carrier is on all fours. It was another case about advertising brochures, a 35-page glossy with many photographs, and it held that even stronger and broader representations were inactionable, that a product was, as this court put it, unmatched for quality, performance, and dependability.
What if you sold me something called premium gas and it turned out it had no more octanes than what you sold me as regular gas?
You didn't lie.
You didn't tell me it had more, but you called one premium and one regular.
Yeah.
Does premium mean something in some context?
We're not making a categorical claim that premium can never mean anything. But it is, and you picked the one example where it sometimes can mean something because there can be regular and premium, and those have specific octanes.
But aren't they saying this is the comparison here between regular and premium vehicles?
No, it's not, because the premium really is very rarely going to have a sufficiently strong meaning to be actionable. And the reason why is it's premium versus what? The case you raise is just one specific instance where they actually do use the word premium pretty consistently, although even there you'll notice there's what's considered premium, there's a mid-grade, and then there's a high-grade. So what's premium is not clear there. But premium is always relative to what you're measuring against. So if it's a hotel chain, you know, Hampton Inn is premium versus some, but in the Hilton hierarchy, it's not the premium, it's you have to go up higher.
Isn't your more basic argument that premium or not, they're simply suing over a defect, and premium and regular cars, neither one are supposed to have defects, so it's not a distinguishing feature
that
of premium cars?
That premium is, whether it's a regular car or a premium car, when it's coming with a warranty that tells you there will be issues and they will be fixed under certain conditions, it's not a promise that a vehicle would never develop a defect. And in fact, no manufacturer, probably of any item that has moving parts, is going to give a warranty or make a statement that they're selling a product that will never have a defect. And that's certainly true of something as complicated as an automobile, where you've got thousands of parts coming from many, many suppliers and sub-suppliers and sub-suppliers. And that promise simply wasn't made here.
But where do you draw the line? Can you think of a situation where there would be such a defect in a car that was promised as a premium vehicle that's not covered by a warranty? Can you see that scenario ever happening?
I don't think with a vehicle the term premium can ever add up to this type of promise. But you don't need to decide that for this case. This is a very narrow case, and it's simply premium here did not add up, particularly when it was on the same page as the warranty, did not add up to a promise that this vehicle would never develop a defect.
What about the next case that comes to us? You know, where do we give attorneys and the public some kind of a prediction and some type of a lesson on this?
Well, I think probably the best test is where the appellate court wound up at. And they went through various tests, but where they wound up at was vague and highly subjective claims of product superiority. I mean, when you have claims like that, like better ingredients, better pizza, best beer in America, those are the kinds of things that are not actionable.
Asking for a categorical rule.
You were asking, I believe, Your Honor, a question of what kind of categorical ruling could there be, and I was trying to answer that question. Mm-hmm. To decide this case, you don't even need to make anything nearly that broad for this case. You don't need to make a broad promulgation as to use a standard like vague and highly subjective, as the 38 other states have done in deciding this.
This a question for the fact finder on a case-by-case basis,
It's kind of similar to a contract case. Normally, the court will decide what the contract means, and there's certain times when the court may say, "Oh, it's ambiguous," and then if it's ambiguous, it may go to the fact finder. What the 38 other states, including Texas, the state that is cited by the Attorney General. What they have decided is that there's a line, and you can't get to a jury unless you get past that line. And what they have various tests, but vague and highly subjective claims are not the kinds of things that you can just say, that's going to go to a jury. So that whatever the plaintiff's counsel wants to pick and say, here's a statement in the brochure, it says the car, that can't go to the jury. Now, it's true that you do need to make a judgment about each state, but courts have done this for many, many years. This court did it in the Carrier decision. 50 plus years ago.
Since you referred to the Attorney General, they give a legislative history that points out why some adjustments, changes that were made to our statute to make it different than the comparable federal statutes.
All that did was make it different with one respect, and that had to do with what the test was. But the test just changed slightly as to whose view, whether it would be a reasonable consumer, and that was the test that changed.
They point out that our statute looks at it from the point of view of the seller and misrepresentations of the seller, not the point of view of the consumer.
Right, and the difference was in the federal case it was likely to deceive, and in the state case it was capacity to deceive, and that was the change. We don't know all the reasons behind what changed that statute. What we do know is from the Attorney General's regulations is that it had to be a representation and that it was settled meanings that referred to. So these were terms going back quite a way. In the State v. Shaw case, one thing, that statute was challenged as being unconstitutionally vague. And the AG, the Attorney General, as this court put it, finding strength in numbers, the state responds that 39 states have similarly worded statutes modeled after federal law. And the AG argued that none of these acts, state or federal, has ever been held to be unconstitutionally vague. And what did this court say? It said, many of these words have acquired settled meanings, deceit, false promises, misrepresentations. And what did this court do? It cited cases from 1964, 1942, 1894. And in fact, in the Attorney General's regulations, in each of those regulations, they all say that they're just promulgating what are settled meanings. So these were long before the change in the statute, which had no substantive impact upon anything in this case. And this court followed that up with the Shaw versus Telco decision, where again, the AG urged in the civil context to give deception a well-settled meaning. And this court upheld it against the chance, even the criminal context, saying statute's unconstitutional only if a business person of reasonable intelligence would fail to understand the broad nature of the acts. Thank you. I see my time is up.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The Attorney General would like just a few minutes of your time, not to discuss the facts of this case specifically, but to hopefully urge this case on some guidance on how you make your decision moving forward. The Attorney General is asking that this court keep the Merchandising Practices Act broad enough and flexible enough to deal with the ever-changing world of unlawful merchandising practices. We see a nearly infinite variety of different types of unlawful merchandising practices, and we cannot predict the new and inventive ways that this statute will be violated in the future. So, the legislature, as well as the Attorney General's office, has promulgated statute and rules that guide this action, as well as other actions under the Merchandising Practices Act, not the common law. And in fact, this court has held that the common law defenses are not available in the MMPA. It is a statutory cause of action. The Attorney General is not asking that advertising be unduly restricted or regulating, but if a statement is made by a merchant, by a seller, that is a misrepresentation or creates a false impression, then that would violate the statute. And so when you're making the decision in this case, we're asking you to refrain from creating overly meticulous definitions of the terms within the MMPA or to carve out broad exceptions as the Western District did in its slip opinion. The biggest way that the Western District did that was by creating an exception for puffery, which does not exist under the MMPA. Of the 9 enumerated violations, ways you can violate 407.020, there were really only 2 at issue in this case, misrepresentations and deception. Misrepresentation decision on this case could be decided without looking at an exception for puffery. Misrepresentation has been defined in 15 CSR 60.9-070 as an assertion that is not in accord with the facts. The Western District spent a good amount of time talking about what is and is not a fact, and that opinion cannot be a fact, and therefore any advertising or other statements by a merchant that are opinion in nature cannot be the basis for a claim of a misrepresentation.
But the regulation also includes the word opinion.
It does, and that's exactly what I was going to say, is that I think the Western District conflated what is the assertion and what is the fact, because assertion is also defined within the regulation to include opinion. Assertion is 15 CSR 60-9.010 subpoint A. It can be words, conduct, or pictorial depiction, can convey present or past fact, law, value, opinion, intention, or other state of mind. In this case, the assertion was, this is a premium vehicle, this is a luxury vehicle, all the other words presented in the evidence. The fact was the condition of the dashboards, whether they bubbled or not. The assertion is what the Western District didn't address at all. And that's the opinion statements by the merchant. To say there is no puffery, you can't ever have an actionable case on opinion, would eliminate the assertion part of the regulation and contradicts that part. And as well as it does create a magic word analysis. Both Nissan as well as the Western District went through and tried to find cases. Is premium an actionable word or not? Is luxury an actionable word or not? And it can't be. We have to look at the totality of the circumstances to see whether or not that assertion is in accord with the facts. And it's same with deception. In fact, even more so. Deception is defined as any method, act, use, practice, ad, or solicitation with the tendency or capacity to mislead, deceive, or cheat, or that creates a false impression. This includes true statements and false statements. It includes opinions and facts. It includes formats. It includes words. To try to create a puffery exception to a deception claim, or to say that deception is not actionable unless you have a measurable and objective fact, completely defeats the purpose of the deception regulation. In fact, a deceptive advertisement or statements can be full of completely true words and still be deceptive because of the way it is formatted or presented. So we do need to look at the totality of the circumstance. And finally, the Attorney General urges this court to keep the focus of the Merchandising Practices Act on the seller, on the merchant, not on the consumer. The consumer is never even mentioned in 407.020, nor is it defined. The entire focus is what were the actions, statements, etc. of the merchant. As soon as you add a reliance element, we're looking not at the merchant, but at the consumer. The Attorney General is not asking this court to adopt any reliance element, Texas or otherwise, but to keep the statute focused where it is, which is on the actions of the merchants. With that, I would turn over all further questions to Mr. Hurst's attorney.
I'd like to piggyback on the Attorney General's comments initially, pointing out that the court's holding below is inconsistent with the statute as it eliminates the fact that the legislature gave authority to the Attorney General to define these terms. And the Attorney General, in fact, said opinion can form the basis for a misrepresentation, and also that the court's usurpation of that definitional role went beyond and conflicts with our previous case law regarding what constitutes puffing. So in regard to the delegation of the responsibility to define, the court was wrong, but it's also wrong in regard to what constitutes puffing under the law. By defining the nature of a misrepresentation to only be something that could be a fact, and calling these assertions in this case, in fact, puffery that is not actionable, is inconsistent both with the statute and with the case law. I'd like to bring your attention to the reality of the case. First of all, we enclosed a photograph of these dashboards. you can't look at these pimpled-looking dashboards in this premium vehicle and say this is consistent with the representations that were made about the car. In fact, no one testified to that.
Can you answer a question I asked opposing counsel, which is, you're pointing out a defect, and people were covered for the defect. What does it have to do with whether it's a luxury vehicle? Presumably, you don't sell vehicles as regular non-luxury vehicles with bubbled dashboards. That's a defect.
Yeah, it is a defect, but it goes to the representation package as a whole. I mean, Mr. List, the representative of Nissan, said that the presentation of this dashboard is inconsistent with the image that we had about this product.
So are you saying that if you sell a luxury vehicle, then if it has defects, it's not a luxury vehicle, it's not a premium vehicle?
I would say that not every defect would be a violation of the premium quality material representation that was made here, but this one clearly is. In fact, the witnesses from Nissan admitted that the prominence and the placement and the overall detraction that this creates to the whole brand of premium impacts that representation and makes this defect, in fact, make that representation inconsistent with the expectation of the consumer.
And where would you draw the line?
I don't know where to draw the line. I just know
the reason I asked it is because they say that the use of the word premium was on the same page as the warranty information. So the warranty information clearly informed the purchaser that there were the expectation that the vehicle was not perfect and that there would need to be repairs made and corrections made. So how do we determine, is it because it's an aesthetic defect or what is it about this defect that takes it outside of just the knowledge you're going to have a problem and the warranty will take care of it?
Well, I think that a warranty conveys the idea that you're covered for certain things. It doesn't necessarily mean that the product's going to have problems. It simply means that there is this contractual remedy available to you when there are problems. But it certainly does not exonerate a party who makes misrepresentations about the high quality of the materials that are utilized from, in fact, having to live up to the expectations of the MMPA. We provide alternative remedies simply by providing a warranty. Doesn't mean that you have disclaimed any responsibility under the MMPA. So in regard to this specific defect, it affected the representation made about the high-quality defect, and as their man List says, it is inconsistent with the vehicle we were selling. Now, I would suspect that there would be other defects, like perhaps the brakes are defective. Well, that wouldn't impact the overall appearance of the vehicle. That wouldn't be inconsistent with a representation showing pictures in the brochures of this high-quality interior. I mean, they go so far as to say everything about the way we presented this vehicle connotes quality. The quality of the paper, the glossiness of the picture was meant to convey an image to the customer about their experience in the car. That's different than a warranty claim, Your Honor, I think. And it's specific as to this case.
And so it is an issue that it impacted the appearance of the vehicle. Is that what you're saying?
It did. It did.
And contrary to premium.
And the customer's perception of their experience with the vehicle, which was so important to these kind of luxury vehicles. It's the impression that you get when you get into the car, and the at least according to Nissan, the comfort that you have of owning such a vehicle, the impression that you want to give to others about the nature of your status in life.
I ask that question is because the words premium and luxury aren't limited to automobiles.
No, they're not.
So anytime, if we rule as you're suggesting we rule, where is there a line between any time something is described as premium or luxury that has a problem, there's a violation of MMPA?
Well, your safeguard, of course, is that these cases are decided on a case-by-case basis. We're both the Attorney General and the plaintiff here are cautioning against an adoption of a magic word formulation here. I mean, certain situations would say that using premium wording and having problems with the vehicle would not be a violation. It's this situation that we're here to talk about because a jury found as a factual matter after hearing evidence that in fact this car did not live up to the representations made in the advertising material and the impression that people had. The witnesses from Nissan of North America agreed with that. They said that this did not live up to those expectations and in fact affected the future value of the vehicles.
Well, and that's what I want to ask about. What is the evidence about the effect on future value? Because you did not have an expert. Did you rely just on owners? And specifically the reason I'm asking is I want to know how, assuming even an owner can testify as to future value of
yes.
their own vehicle, why would that apply to class members?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and we cite to you the Ameristar case, and I'd like to call the court's mind to the language there because I think it's so so persuasive for understanding this issue as you've decided it previously. Here's what you said. In some cases, the evidence weighed in common experience demonstrates that a substantial pecuniary loss has occurred. But at the same time, it is apparent that the loss is of a character which defies exact proof. In that situation, it is reasonable to require a lesser degree of certainty as to the amount of loss, leaving a greater degree of discretion to the court or jury.
That was not a class action.
No, but
that had to do with airplanes. We're talking here about testify about...
Well, you have always allowed testimony of an owner to establish their value of a case, and certainly the admission of the defendant that, in fact, this defect affected the value of the brand.
But and I understand your argument. You think, gosh, if it applies to this vehicle, it should apply to other vehicles, but that's what we have experts for. I'm not aware of any case, and if you know one, please tell me, where someone can testify, where we have authorized broadening the exception that says an owner knows the value of their own property
yes.
to allow them then to testify about the value of other similar property owned by other people. I understand you want us to make that leap, and why, but
I'm not asking you to make any leap. It was an admission of the defendant that it affected the entire brand and affected the value of the brand, and they were aware of it and were concerned about it. That is the link between then the testimony of the individuals about how much it would cost to repair those vehicles. We had that from several sources, the individuals that
but
testified.
But almost all of them were repaired, and your lead plaintiff was repaired.
Yes, but they were repaired with countermeasure 2 dashboards, which also had the defect. So the repair didn't take care of the problem. The repair still left the problem in place, and that was the testimony the jury heard. But the unequivocal testimony of the defendants was this affected the entire brand. This was not in doubt. And with that basis, the individual testimony about the amount of damages, in fact, bridges that link.
Well, it was in doubt. They denied the stigma. They admitted a defect which they claimed they repaired except in individual instances. They denied a stigma loss, and you all said there was a stigma loss.
Yes, and their witnesses admitted that there was an effect upon the brand.
But there's a difference.
Angelitas, their witness.
I'm sorry.
There's a difference between an effect upon the brand and testimony that the future value of a particular vehicle is a certain amount.
Well, remember our measure of damages here. It's benefit of the bargain. And in every case that you have decided, you have said that the cost of repair is, in fact, an adequate measure of benefit of bargain damages. And so we had testimony about the cost of repair of every one of these vehicles. The defect existed in every single model.
But almost all of them recovered that already. So what other damages?
But not with a repair that worked. All of the repairs that had been made were of the countermeasure 2 dashboards that also had the defect and were now bubbling. So the reality was that even the fix that had been performed left the vehicles with the same dashboards that did not meet the representations within the brochures.
On cross-examination, some of your witnesses admitted that they had the fix, but that they were still worried that they would get punished on trade-in.
Yes, and that was part of the stigma damages as well, is that this was a pervasive situation which was affecting the resale of these cars, and therefore we think that met the necessary evidentiary burden that we had to establish stigma across the brand without an expert, Your Honor.
And who were those witnesses?
The witnesses were the individuals that testified at trial, and we list them in our briefs, the individual plaintiffs in the case, class representatives, but also other purchasers of the vehicle, but also Mr. Angelides from Nissan, Mr. List from Nissan, who all were parties that admitted that this was a pervasive problem that affected everything. But one last point before I sit down. I know I'm over time. The question becomes for you, I think, is whether or not there is evidence of fact of damage, not amount. In the court below, the question was specifically asked, are you denying the amount of damages claimed, and to which the response was no, we're simply denying that they weren't injured at all. And I suggest that looking at these dashboards, you can see, as a matter of common sense, that every individual that bought these was in fact damaged. The only question was how much, and they don't contest how much, only that this didn't damage anyone. And I think that that is simply not supported by the evidence. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Quite a few points. With respect to the record and what he said that Nissan admits, we dealt with this at length in our reply brief. Nissan doesn't admit anything of what he's saying at all. We didn't admit stigma. None of our witnesses admitted stigma. Page 27 of our reply brief deals with the testimony of Nick Angelides. So that just didn't happen. There's no proof of that. He says he has all this tremendous proof. He would have been able to get an expert and do it. He says the value dropped. He can't prove it. The witnesses that he used, the only ones who testified, the one we already talked about, everyone else had an unremedied dashboard at the time they testified, unremedied dashboard, including the class representative. With respect to ascertainable loss, he goes, all these dashboards are bad. We went into great length in our briefs explaining that it's 0.25% for the Countermeasure 2 dashboards, just like the one on the class representative. No case has ever allowed the type of testimony here to carry over to an entire class. It's never happened. It's never happened in Missouri, and it's never happened elsewhere. And it's never happened elsewhere because every class action, there is always an expert to show that there's loss across the entire class. Sometimes it might be broken to subclasses, but there's always an expert to testify as to damages, and they couldn't find that here. With respect to jumping back to opinion, that's a red herring. There's no issue of opinion here. There's no opinion that was given. So this just doesn't impact it. With respect to the regulations, you can actually look at what the regulations say. They all reference misrepresentation. They all reference settled meetings. And what they're saying is that this was a misrepresentation. And the fact is, it wasn't. The settled meetings were things from like Carrier that had puffery doctrine for a long, long time for the term misrepresentation, which is exactly what's at issue here. So all the things you heard about opinion, all the things you heard about all these other types of scenarios that might happen, and we deal with this in our reply brief, that's got nothing to do with this case, nothing to do with protecting the consumer. The MMPA gives lots of protections, but
you
still have to show misrepresentation.
Mr. McClay's argument about the aesthetic defects are the kinds of things that are covered under the MMPA as opposed to products liability, dangerous defects would be covered under a difference.
Yeah, it doesn't make a difference what the kind of defect is. There's no promise here that whatever happened to the car would never happen. Remember, that's the promise they need, not just that it would happen and that we would fix it as we did for the class representative and many others. There are only two in the class who have it that it's not a new dashboard. So I think that's a situation there. No state, and they all have similar statutes, has done what the plaintiffs ask and what the Attorney General asked. The Attorney General wanted to change the statute, change the meaning of representation. They'd have to issue new regulations. Even in Texas, which applies the least, which is what the Attorney General points us to, they apply the least sophisticated consumer standard, as friendly as you could get. And when this case was in Texas with the same counsel, it was dismissed in federal court. And why? Because there are cases in Texas that say For Mercedes, the best engineered car in the world, they say that's not actionable. Why? Because it's a vague and highly subjective statement, and that's not the kind of thing that's actionable. And here there was no promise, and particularly there was no loss. And I know we haven't talked about this, but if I can just add the last thing, this class never should have been certified in the first place. We explained why that is in our briefs, and I know I'm out of time. So
thank you. Case will be submitted.